it's really a pleasure to experience this happening in Bergen. More than 18 years, more than 20 years after we first started working with the Wittgenstein edition in Norway. And I notice also with pleasure that are some unfamiliar faces. And there are at least three generations of Wittgenstein philosophers here. When we started this work a long time ago, we had many, many worries, of course. One of the worries we had that we were was whether we would be able to do a good enough job or not. Another worry was, what if when we finished all this, because we knew it was going to take a long time, there is no interest in Wittgenstein anymore? That might, of course, also happen. It does not seem to have happened. And we're also very happy about that. So, what I intend to do today is to give a presentation of the electronic Nachlass edition, but also the history of the project and the methods behind it. Can you hear me?
Yeah. I think it's... Is it good enough?
Comparatively well.
I'll try to speak up. Before I come to the talk itself, so to speak, I'd like to say a few words about my own motivation for the work that I have been involved in with the Wittgenstein Archives. And I'd like to just pick out two memories that I had. One from a conversation I had with Peter Winch, I think it was in 1987, when my involvement in this had just begun. And I eagerly tried to convince him that a computerized version of the Nachlass would be the right thing to do. So, can you still hear me? Okay. And I used some term like Wittgenstein research, that this would be good for Wittgenstein research. And then Peter Winch said that, well, you see, that is where we disagree, because I don't think of myself as doing research. We're in scholarship, which is an entirely different thing. And I went home and was a little bit depressed and thought about this. Whether we were living in different worlds. Later, Winch became one of the Wittgenstein trustees, and we cooperated very well together. Then in 1990, Hintikka said in a talk and in an article on the efforts that were being made at producing various kinds of editions of Wittgenstein's Nachlass, among them an electronic edition, that electronic editing is okay per se, but it may divert attention in philosophically uninteresting ways. He was concerned, of course, that philosophers might end up counting words instead of interpreting them. And to me, that seemed like a big paradox, because my general impression of Wittgenstein scholarship at that time was that there were all too many people concerned with not counting words, but discussing the relationship of manuscripts to the or publications to their manuscript sources, and details of dating and of details of interpretation of manuscripts, and whether things were correctly read and printed or not, etc. And too little attention was being paid to Wittgenstein's philosophy. So my idea was that, well, perhaps by combining philology and the technology, we could be to the service of philosophy by making the Wittgenstein Nachlass generally available and make an end to all this discussion about what the text really says and what is the right edition, etc. I'll hope to come back briefly to this hope of mine towards the end of this talk. Now, the outline of the rest of what I'm going to say is, first I'll give a few words of background to the project, then about the history of the edition, its contents. I'll give you some key figures about the volume and the costs of the edition. Then I'll spend some time on its editorial methods, and finally a few words about its relevance for philosophy. Now, the background, as you all know, or an important part of the background, is the fact that Wittgenstein himself published only one book of philosophy, the Tractatus, and a couple of absolutely minor other things. And most of the books we have from Wittgenstein have been published posthumously. Even until the Nachlass was published in electronic form in year 2000, it has been estimated by my dear colleague, Arvid Bichler, that only somewhere between a quarter and a third of the Nachlass had actually been published in print. Now, that sounds worse than it really is, because as we'll see, the Nachlass is rather repetitious in a way. So, I don't know whether one can measure philosophical content, but anyhow, if one can, it doesn't mean that as little as one third or a quarter of the philosophical content of Wittgenstein's Nachlass has been published. As years passed by, the philosophical audience became concerned that the printed publications were not up to text critical standards. The sources were not documented to the extent and to the detail that one is used to in text critical editions, for example. Now, that is not no surprise, because these publications were not originally intended as text critical publications at all. It was only as after there had been a growing interest in Wittgenstein that there was also an interest in a text critical edition or a complete edition. Anyhow, there was a lot of concern, not only with the fact that there were problems with details, but also with the fact that not everything had been published. So there were all sorts of speculations going on about the things that were being hidden from view, as some put it. So in an attempt to remedy this, the trustees published the so-called Cornell microfilm in 1967, which was a complete microfilm facsimile of the entire Nachlass, or the parts of the Nachlass which were known by then. And at the same time, von Bricht pointed out that as time passes, the demand will arise for some form of complete works, including, in addition to the things already printed, most or perhaps all the manuscripts with scholarly comments on variants and so forth. So, what is the Nachlass? It consists of 20,000 pages, manuscripts, typescripts. They vary from rough drafts to almost finished fair copies and typescripts, almost ready for publication. But many of them are heavily revised. Most of them are heavily revised. So we find all the phenomena that one usually finds in modern manuscript sources. Deletions, insertions, substitutions, etc., cross-references. With Wittgenstein, very often something which looks like instructions to the editor. There are many indications in the Nachlass that Wittgenstein was thinking of publication, because it gives instructions in margins and in parentheses, etc., which seemed to be directed towards a publisher. There are also lots of rearrangements. The famous story about Wittgenstein's method of working, or method of writing, is taken from one of von Wright's articles on the Nachlass, where he explains how Wittgenstein would start working by making some notes in a notebook, and then going through the notebooks, he would copy his notes, revising them, refining them into a ledger or a volume of some sort. And then he might take that volume, manuscript volume, and dictate it to a typist, all the time making small changes, of course. And then he took the typescript and cut it up into pieces, rearranged the pieces, and had it dictated once again with small changes here and there. And that, of course, results in a Nachlass which is repetitious in the sense that I mentioned a few minutes ago. Here is an example of a manuscript page, the kind, typical kind of problem that an editor is faced with. This is from manuscript number 171. And I don't know whether you can read it from where you sit. That's not terribly important right now. It says something like, nicht das ist uns der Wichtige, ein Wichtiger, das Wichtige, up there in the corner. Aspect, das, die evidence, etc., etc., etc. The point is that, you see that double slash up there? That marks an alternative ending of the sentence that he started on the top of that page. And this entire paragraph here, which is full of slashes, constitutes alternative starters, beginnings of the very same sentence. So that whole page contains only one sentence, but in some 30 and some variants, at least. And then later in that manuscript, he stops now and then and comes back to that same sentence and starts working it over again. So of course, publishing something like that in book four, according to any of the known conventions for text critical editions or whatnot, would be a task so huge that it seems frightening. In Oslo, the university library acquired a copy of the so-called Cornell microfilm in 1976. It was bought in cooperation between all the four departments of philosophy in Norway. We had only four universities, so we had four departments of philosophy. They went together on this. And in 1980, they started the Norwegian Wittgenstein project, which was also a cooperation between all four universities. What they had experienced working with the microfilm, the Cornell microfilm, was that, well, although it gave them access to the entire Nachlass, it was very difficult to retrieve stuff with that. So they started cataloging it. And in cataloging it, they used computers. And they, in order to make it searchable in a sensible way, they started attaching keywords to the various manuscripts, and then they found that they were so much in disagreement about which keywords to attach to each manuscript that it was better to just transcribe the whole thing. And that is how that project started. The project transcribed something like 3,200 pages before it stopped because of copyright problems, which I think Kenny will come back to in a talk later today. So the project was closed in 1987. And then we restarted the project in Bergen, then called the Wittgenstein Archives and organized by the University of Bergen. By then we had resolved the copyright issues and we had made a contract with not only the trustees but also with Oxford University Press about publication. So during the next 10 years, this project was finished because the rest of the work was just to transcribe this material, edit it, publish it. question often asked, why Bergen? Well, as I said, this started as a cooperation between all four Norwegian universities. Bergen had many philosophers who were very interested in Wittgenstein and had so for a long time. Trondheim was in Bergen before he moved to Oslo. Also Mehler, who now is in Tromsø, was in Bergen originally. And Nordenstam and Johannesen were still in Bergen, were also among the philosophers who were very interested in Wittgenstein. There are also other names I could have mentioned here. I mentioned these because they've also all been involved in either the Norwegian Wittgenstein project or the Wittgenstein archives. Actually, I should have mentioned Ari Utaker too, who sits here somewhere. I'm sorry, Ari. Another reason why it ended up in Bergen was that we had what is now called the HIT Center, the Center for Computing and Humanities, who specialize in humanities software, cultural heritage documentation, language technology, all sorts of things, but also what we now call text technology, that is text encoding and text editing, or scholarly editing. The HIT Center had worked with Ibsen for many years. It has worked with the Text Encoding Initiative, which I'll come back to briefly, and then also with Wittgenstein. Now, to the contents of this edition. But first, what is it? What kind of edition is this? Is this a text-critical edition? Yes or no? Depending on how you define text-critical edition. And I have learned through the years that textual scholars do not all agree in the definition of what a text-critical edition is. But I think most of them would agree that this is what one could call a documentary edition. That is, in a standard traditional text-critical edition, what happens is that you have several witnesses for one text. So you choose one of the texts as your base text, and you document the variation through in an apparatus. We haven't done that. We have published all the texts as they are, in quotation marks, that is, as individual manuscripts. So even if there are two individual manuscripts who are almost identical, except for a few differences in detail, we will have reproduced them as two different transcriptions, two different manuscripts. Part of the reason for that decision was simply a practical consideration. To do that kind of editorial work is such a huge task that it seemed economically unfeasible we would be able to finance such a project. But another reason was not only practical, namely that however you do that, whichever principles you use in producing a more traditional synthetic, I prefer to call them synthetic edition, there are interpretational and editorial principles and decisions involved which in the, should I say, climate around the Wittgenstein Atlas would be problematic, because no matter what kind of job you did and how good you were able to do it, it would become just as disputed as and not resolve the problems with the lack of access to the Nachlass. So we have transcribed and published manuscript and typescript one by one and put them together. But we present the text in three different forms: a normalized transcription, a diplomatic transcription, and a facsimile. And of course, since it's an electronic publication, we have emphasized that it should facilitate word searching, searches for phrases and content elements, references, and facilitate certain kinds of analysis. Now, let's have a look at it. When you open the edition. The first thing you see is the table of contents. In this table of contents, refers to an introduction, a user guide, and a README file at the bottom there. But the important things are these three: the normalized, the diplomatic transcription, and the facsimile. Now, most people, surprisingly enough, will most of the time work with the so-called normalized edition. And what is the normalized version? What is the normalized version? One way of putting it is to say that in the normalized version, we stick as close to simple book print as possible. So what the file I just opened is, well, perhaps not in the beginning, but at least as we get further down there, looks pretty much like a traditional print edition. And it means that we have silently corrected many of Wittgenstein's errors. If there is a typo or a slip of the pen, which is an obvious typo or a slip of the pen, we will have corrected it. If there's a spelling error, we will have corrected it. If something is deleted, it will have been left out. Spelling will have been normalized to a certain quasi-Wittgenstein standard, which we have, which is our only sign. And so forth. And of course, you can read this from the screen, but probably you would not prefer not to. An electronic edition mainly has other purposes than just simply reading. If that's what you want to do, I recommend you take a printout and read from paper. You can access the transcription by the table, by its table of contents. The table of contents is not perhaps aesthetically very pleasing, but it is identical to a list of items in von Wright's catalogue to the Nachlass. So to anyone who has worked with the Nachlass, this will look familiar. So we can look up item 115, for example. Or let's just go directly to item 115. Philosophische Bemerkungen, Philosophische Untersuchungen. A few blank pages in the beginning, and then a remark on the first page from Wittgenstein saying that this book is all bad, etc., as he usually says, but also making us aware that somewhere in the middle of the manuscript book, he has started another manuscript, so to say, another text, which is called Versuch einer Umarbeitung. So we have realized that as a hypertext link, which so that if you click on that link, you're brought to that position further down in the text, which is the beginning of Philosophische Untersuchungen. Versuch einer Umarbeitung, page 118 of item number 115. And as you see, this is one of several versions of the beginning of the philosophical investigations. Augustinus beschreibt das Lernen der menschlichen Sprache so, etc., etc., blah, blah. This is all well known to all of you, I guess. What I'd like to draw your attention to is something which may be difficult to see on this screen. This text is in black, this is in blue. There's a comma here somewhere. Here, it's in red. That the comma is in red means that we have added it. Anything that is added by the editors is in red. That this part of the text is in black means that there are variant readings which have not been deleted by Wittgenstein underneath there somewhere. And we can look at them if you want to. They are hidden from you, but if we instruct the program to show us in text, it shows us these the other substitutions. And a lot of other stuff, which I shall not bother you with now. Now, if you're interested in more detail of this, then you turn to the diplomatic transcription. And here is the diplomatic version of the same text. Item 115, page 118. Philosophisch untersuchen, versuch eine Umarbeitung. Now this gives an ad literam transcription, so to speak. As you can see, both these alternatives are rendered, but it's indicated in with red marks according to a certain convention that one of them has been inserted above the line. You can see down here that there are red marks and an arrow on that S, which means that it has been inserted and that the insertion has been marked in a certain way. And you probably notice that we have also reproduced deleted text. And I guess there are spelling errors, etc., too here, because it's rare to find more than half a page of Wittgenstein without any spelling errors. I think. Is that fair? No, it's not fair. Sorry. Okay. Now, if you want to have a look at the facsimile, then you put volume 1 image disk in your CD-ROM drive. Giving a talk in a demonstration, it's a good idea to do that beforehand. And it's an even better idea to install the program properly. Can somebody tell some jokes? Please. There we are. Now, this takes time because it's on the CD-ROM drive. On the PC down in the corner, it's stored on the hard disk, and leafing through manuscripts goes a lot quicker. Now, the first page we got up here, came up here, is of course the page that we wanted. Philosophische Untersuchungen, Versuch einer Umarbeitung. That definitely doesn't display very well on this screen. I recommend that you don't judge the quality from what you see here, but rather from what you see on the computer down in the corner. Take a look at that. But anyhow, the facsimile is here and available, so that if you are in doubt about transcription or for some other reason want to have a closer look at the manuscripts, you can. In fact, you can have a very close look if you like. Absolutely close. So much for the normalized diplomatic version and the facsimile. Now, of course, one of the most interesting things about an electronic text is that it is searchable. We can search for things here. We can search for things like, now, you remember the discussion yesterday about Unsinn and sinnlos, los. There are 596 occurrences of Unsinn and 318 occurrences of sinnlos. That is 15, but there are only 15 sections or paragraphs which contain the same, both words. Now, interestingly enough, there are no occurrences of Unsinn, sinnlos. Well, that is not what is so interesting. It's to be expected. But there is an occurrence of Unsinn and sinnlos within a distance of each other, for not more than one word. And what is that? there's a substitution between seen nodes and unseen. Actually, this is not a very good example, but I picked it because it came up in yesterday's discussion. But typically, the way that this kind of tool can be of help in interpretational problems is the situation like the one we had yesterday. What do you typically do? You search for unseen, and you search for seen nodes. And sometimes you may find that in a certain period of time, Wittgenstein uses one word a lot and the other not at all, and then vice versa. Sometimes you may find that they very often occur in that they very often co-occur, or that they don't co-occur. And sometimes you find that the one substitute is substituting the other. Now, if we found 10 cases where we substituted unseen for seen nodes or seen nodes for unseen, that would probably be very helpful, because it would show us in which cases he was in doubt, where he was confused himself, or perhaps it would show cases where he was correcting himself some years after, going through a manuscript, etc. Searching, you can search not only for words. You can limit your search to certain Nachlass items, to certain groups of items, Bände, dictations, manuscripts, typescripts, to certain periods of time, to Geheimschriftstellen, if that is of interest. You can search for persons, of course. One of the problems with searching for personal names is that, especially in German, they occur in all sorts of fashions. There are derivations from names, etc. Russischen. We have normalized all personal names so that they can be searched for in their standard form. There are parts of the Nachlass which are written in English, in French, in Latin. These are separated out so that you can search separately in these for text in these languages. In another search template, this one, the upper half of this one is identical to the previous one. The difference starts here. You can search for graphics, logical notation, mathematical notation, set theoretical notation, musical notation, and miscellaneous notation. Now, these are all phenomena which are not textual in the sense that they cannot be searched by word searches. So therefore, by help of two of the persons present here, actually, Michael Biggs, Richard, there, and Bill Booz, there, done a lot of work helping us classify these various things. So if you're interested in pictures of faces, you can search for them. And and here they are, lots of faces. What's this good for? Well, I think Michael can say a little bit more about that. One of the more trivial things that it's good for is that, as you know, it often happens when you're working with a text that you want to find back to something, and you don't remember exactly how the phrasing was, but it was somewhere close to an illustration which looked like that. There are other uses for this kind of thing too, of course. Okay. Some key figures. These are questions often asked. As I said, the Nachlass contains 20,000 pages, so of course this edition also contains 20,000 pages. They constitute 3 multi-million words. Since they occur in two forms, you might say 6 million words, but that would be to cheat, I think. The edition contains 200,000 hypertext links. 5,000 of these links are implementations of links created by Wittgenstein himself. Wittgenstein saying things like, look, see page 14 in bunt Q, things like that. The other 190,000 are creates, are links created by us in order to help giving tools to maneuver to in the edition. There are 2 million encoded elements. Come back to that. It took 10 years plus. The Wittgenstein archive started in 1990. That took 10 years, but a lot of work had been going on before that. The Wittgenstein archives spent 40 man years in the way, which gives you a throughput of, on an average, 2 pages per person per day. A total budget of 14 million Norwegian crowns, which, oh, this is the currency. The exchange rate has changed since I made this. This must be something like 1 million pounds now. And the sales price is sometimes felt alarming by people. Therefore, I also always mention that last. Nobody will recoup their expenses on this edition from the sales. So, a few words about editorial methods. One of the paradoxical questions one of the paradoxes that you find yourself in when you're doing this kind of work is that whereas the aim of philosophy is to interpret, of course, the aim of any philosopher working on Wittgenstein is to interpret Wittgenstein's texts. Our aim is exactly the obvious. We're not supposed to interpret the texts. The aim of a diplomatic edition is to represent the text as accurately as possible. Because we are supposed to serve you philosophers and give you the text in an undistorted form so that it's basic for you to form your interpretations of Wittgenstein's philosophy. Now, that is easily said, but not as always as easily done. Everybody can read the first part of this paragraph. Die Sprache muss als ganze Institution genommen und betrachtet werden. But what does he say there? Etc. That's secret writing. Since we were producing a diplomatic edition, I instructed transcribers at the project to transcribe these Geheimschriften ad litera. So, transcribers were supposed to transcribe it this way. Die Sprache muss als ganzes genommen werden, und betrachtet werden. Etc. And then, of course, after a while, I discovered, looking over people's shoulders, that in order to comply with this rule of transcription, what they did was that they first decoded the text into normal language, and then they recoded it back to Geheimschrift to get it right. Because there is, of course, no way that you can tell from Wittgenstein's handwriting whether something is an H or a B or whatever, an N or an M and a U, it's in the middle of a word, except by interpreting the whole thing. So, we changed that. So transcribers transcribe it this way. Die schlechte Orthographie meiner Jugendjahre bis etwa ins 18. oder 19. hängt mit meinem ganzen übrigen Charakter der Schwäche im Lernen zusammen. And then a computer program translates back to Geheimschrift. You may ask whether that makes sense, but it's fun. So there are basic conflicting requirements here. We want a normalized representation, we want a diplomatic representation, and we want an edition which is suited for searches and for processing on linguistic criteria. The solution to that problem is to use genetic markup. Now, I think we'll skip a few points here. The aims of the transcription work is, of course, that the transcription should be interpretationally sound. That goes without saying. It should be accurate, it should be true to the original, you should also be consistent, systematic. Actually, my aim at least was that in some sense it should be falsifiable or verifiable, different choice. What do I mean by that? The typical case, substitutions, variant readings. This is an example, an artificial example in my handwriting. It's always much easier to work with artificial examples than real ones. Imagine Wittgenstein writing this. Das große Schloss, Haus, deleting Schloss probably, and then perhaps before or after that, inserting Weiser. How many readings does that give you? Well, before we start talking about readings, we want diplomatic rendering, so we should somehow be able to mark that Weiser has been inserted and Schloss has been deleted. Then the readings, das große Weiße Haus, das große Weiße Schloss, das große Schloss, das Weiße Haus, das große Haus, das Weiße Schloss. You could argue for all of these readings. Now, the context will often tell you which reading is the right one, you might say. But very often, actually, it doesn't. So we introduce a rule, which, without going into any detail, simply states that, in this case, the two first readings are readings. The others are not readings. But, so, what I say is that the aim of diplomatic edition is to get every letter right. The alpha text requirement and the beta text requirement are two specifications of the aims of the normalized transcription, which are to get every word right and to get every reading right. The criteria that we have used in our transcription rules are very simple. First of all, we introduce the notion of well-formedness, and basically what that says is that a well-formed text is one that is orthographically acceptable, grammatically well-formed, etc. Then we say that among interpretationally acceptable transcriptions, we prefer the more well-formed. We didn't try to be explicit about rules for what is interpretationally acceptable. We say that among acceptable transcriptions, we should choose the ones which are well-formed, in this sense as well. And what is the criterion, the rock-bottom criterion here? I say that it's agreement among competent readers which decides. If two readers agree that the word here is this or that, listen, all right, whatever, then it's probably that word. If 1,000 competent readers agree that it is, but if 500 are on one side and 500 on the other side, then we have a problem and we make a comment or a remark of some sort. So this transcription rule or procedure is very simple. First rule is transcribe everything in linear order. Pretend that it's a printed book that Wittgenstein has written. And then make exceptions only if certain criteria are fulfilled. I don't get into any detail about these here. And then there is also a set of rules about what kinds of exceptions you are allowed and in which order of priority you are allowed to make these exceptions. I realize that because of time constraints, I will not be able to share with you my thoughts about the relevance of this work for philosophy, nor about the future. I think you can live without that. So therefore, I will just go straight to the end and say that if you want more information, you can find it on the Wittgenstein Archives webpage. Thank you.